A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And I think it's one of those questions where the deeper you dig, the more uncomfortable it gets. He's asking about Gardner. Not just what they do, but what they actually are. They're the canonical example of a firm that acts as hired eyes and ears for market due diligence. The firm that gave us the hype cycle and the magic quadrant. But their business model has always been a bit murky. They sell research to buyers, and they sell access to vendors. Same firm, both sides of the table. Daniel's question is basically, when research is commercially motivated, how do we tell the difference between analysis and marketing? And he wants the history, how we got here, and whether the criticisms have merit.
Imagine your CTO just approved a $2 million cloud security deal. The justification memo cites a Gartner Magic Quadrant that placed the vendor in the leader's quadrant. Solid due diligence, right? Now imagine that vendor pays Gartner $500,000 a year in client access fees. Same placement, same quadrant, but suddenly you're asking a different set of questions.
That's the thing. Last year, Gartner's revenue crossed $6 billion. About 30% comes from vendor-facing services, the rest from end-user subscriptions. So the same company is being paid by the people buying the software and the people selling it.
Which is exactly the structural tension Daniel's pointing at. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's a business model question. And it matters because Gartner isn't just another research firm. They shaped how entire industries think about technology adoption. The hype cycle, first published in 1995, became a mental model people use for everything from AI to cryptocurrency to corporate training programs. The Magic Quadrant, first published in 1996, literally determines which vendors get procurement meetings and which ones get ghosted.
Daniel put it well. This is a case study in how research can be dishonest if commercially motivated, or how marketing can masquerade as research and awards. He's careful to say Gartner isn't necessarily a bad organization, but the business model is complex, and the criticisms have at least some merit. So where do we even start?
Let's start with what Gartner actually is, because most people know the name without knowing the machine behind it. Founded in 1979 by Gideon Gartner, a former Oppenheimer analyst. The original pitch was technology advisory for investors, helping Wall Street understand this new thing called the IT industry. But through the 80s and 90s, they pivoted hard toward enterprise IT buyers. CIOs needed someone to make sense of a rapidly fragmenting vendor landscape, and Gartner positioned itself as the neutral arbiter. It's the entire value proposition. If Gartner isn't seen as objective, the whole thing collapses. But here's where it gets interesting. As they grew, they developed two products that became more influential than the firm itself. These aren't just reports. They're frameworks that changed how people think.
Let's take the hype cycle first, because it's genuinely clever. Innovation trigger. The breakthrough. The lab result. The demo that makes everyone's eyes go wide. Then the peak of inflated expectations. Press coverage explodes, VC money pours in, and someone inevitably claims this technology will end war or solve climate change. Then the trough of disillusionment. The backlash, the failed pilots, the articles asking whatever happened to. Then the slope of enlightenment. The slow, boring work of figuring out what the thing is actually good for. And finally, the plateau of productivity. Mainstream adoption, boring and reliable.
What's brilliant is that it's descriptive, not predictive. Gartner didn't claim to forecast where technologies would go. They mapped where they'd been. But once the hype cycle became famous, it started influencing the very dynamics it was supposed to describe. Being placed at the peak of inflated expectations could actually inflate expectations. Being dumped into the trough could accelerate disillusionment. It became self-fulfilling.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
I'm sorry?
The hype cycle. It's a framework that sounds analytical but works emotionally. It gives executives permission to be skeptical of the hot new thing and patient with the boring old thing. It's a decision-making prosthetic disguised as a research methodology.
Actually, a really good way to put it. And the Magic Quadrant is even more powerful, because it doesn't just describe a market, it ranks the players, completeness of vision on the horizontal, ability to execute on the vertical, leaders up top right, challengers top left, visionaries bottom right, niche players bottom left.
Being in the top right is worth millions. Being in the bottom left can kill your pipeline.
Here's the part most people don't know. The methodology is proprietary. Gartner doesn't publicly disclose how they weight the criteria that determine placement. They describe the process in broad terms. Analyst evaluations, customer references, product demonstrations, market share data. But the actual weighting formula is a black box.
You're being graded on a curve you can't see. By a grader, you're also paying.
That's the tension. And it's not theoretical. In 2019, the Wall Street Journal ran a major investigation into Gartner's practices. They found that Gartner analysts were evaluated partly on how much revenue they generated from the vendors in their coverage area. Former analysts told the journal they felt pressure to align Magic Quadrant placements with vendor spending.
Pressure to align. That's a phrase doing some heavy lifting of its own.
It's the polite version of what critics call pay to play. The journal piece quoted a former senior analyst who said, paraphrasing, that if a large vendor was spending heavily on Gartner services and got a poor placement, the analyst would get a call asking why.
Gartner's response.
They've consistently denied that vendor spending influences research outcomes. They say their research division is firewalled from sales. They point to their ombudsman office and methodology review processes. And to be fair, many former analysts say they never experienced direct pressure. But the structural incentive is there. The same company profits from both the test and the tutoring.
That's the phrase that sticks with me. Selling the test and the tutoring. It's not that every analyst is corrupt. It's that the business model creates a gravitational pull toward favorable treatment, and individual integrity has to constantly resist it.
There's a specific legal case worth mentioning. In 2021, a small cybersecurity vendor called NSS Labs filed a lawsuit against Gartner. They allege that Gartner manipulated their Magic Quadrant placement after NSS Labs declined to purchase additional services. The case eventually settled, but the allegations were detailed. NSS Labs claimed they'd been placed in the Leaders Quadrant in previous years, and then, after they stopped spending, they were dropped to niche players despite what they argued was objectively improved product capability.
A 40% drop in qualified leads after being bumped from leaders to visionaries. That was a different case. A cloud security vendor in 2022. Placement changed. Pipeline collapsed. No change in the actual product.
That's the Gartner tax, the cost of not playing the game. Vendors report that being excluded from a Magic Quadrant or receiving a poor placement can cost millions in lost deals, which creates immense pressure to purchase advisory services, attend conferences, buy reprint rights. It's not a bribe in an envelope. It's a system where the cost of non-participation is existential.
Let's talk about how this actually plays out on the buyer's side, because that's where Daniel's question really bites. You're a procurement team. You've got 15 vendors claiming to solve your problem. You don't have time to evaluate all of them deeply. So you pull up the Magic Quadrant, see who's in leaders, and shortlist from there.
That's exactly what happens. A 2023 procurement survey found that 68% of IT buyers use Magic Quadrant placement as a primary vendor selection criterion, as in, the first filter. But only 12% said they understood how the quadrant was actually constructed.
So the majority of buyers are outsourcing their due diligence to a methodology they don't understand, produced by a firm with a documented financial incentive to favor certain vendors.
That's the charitable reading. The less charitable reading is that Gartner has successfully positioned itself as an outsourced conscience for IT procurement. You don't have to do the hard work of evaluating vendors because Gartner did it for you. And if the vendor you pick turns out to be a disaster, you can point to the Magic Quadrant and say, "We followed best practice."
Covering the covers. It's like covering a song, but you're covering someone else's analysis. You're not doing due diligence. You're doing the appearance of due diligence, using someone else's work as a shield.
Here's the parallel that makes me uncomfortable. This is exactly what happened with Moody's and Standard & Poor's in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. The issuer pays model. Bond issuers paid the rating agencies for their ratings. The agencies had every incentive to inflate those ratings because if they didn't, the issuer would take their business to the other agency. We got AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities full of subprime loans.
The buyers, pension funds, institutional investors, relied on those ratings as if they were objective scientific assessments.
Because the entire regulatory system was built around them. You couldn't buy certain assets unless they were rated. Just like today, in many large organizations, you literally cannot put a vendor on the shortlist unless they appear in the magic quadrant. It's not a suggestion, it's embedded in procurement policy.
Gardner's defense would be that their model is different. The rating agencies were paid only by issuers. Gartner is paid by both buyers and sellers. The buyer subscriptions, which are the majority of revenue, theoretically create a countervailing incentive. If the research is bad, buyers cancel.
That's not nothing. Gartner's end-user subscription revenue is about 70% of the business. Those are real CIOs paying real money for what they believe is independent analysis. If Gartner's research lost credibility with buyers, the business would suffer. So there is a market mechanism pushing toward accuracy.
It's a slow mechanism. Credibility erodes gradually. In the meantime, the vendor revenue, 30% of $6 billion, is real money, arriving quarterly, tied to specific relationships and specific placements.
There's another layer. Even if the research is perfectly objective, the magic quadrant creates winner-take. Most dynamics that reduce competition. Vendors in the leaders quadrant get disproportionate attention. Vendors and niche players struggle to get meetings, even if they have a better product for specific use cases. The quadrant doesn't just describe market concentration, it accelerates it.
Which means Gartner is not a passive observer of the markets it analyzes. It's an active participant. The hype cycle shapes adoption curves. The magic quadrant shapes competitive dynamics. These aren't neutral measurement tools. They're market-making instruments.
That brings us to the most interesting question Daniel's prompt raises. If the frameworks are commercially motivated and structurally conflicted, but also useful, what do you do with them?
We should get into that. But first I want to sit with the history a bit more, because understanding how Gartner became Gartner is key to understanding why the conflicts are so hard to resolve.
Let's talk about the category Gartner occupies, because it's weirder than most people realize. They're not a consultancy in the McKinsey sense. They're not a research firm in the academic sense. They're what the industry calls an analyst firm, alongside Forrester, IDC, and a handful of others. The business model is essentially, we will be your hired eyes and ears. We'll track vendor movements, product roadmaps, pricing trends, and competitive dynamics so you don't have to.
Which makes sense as a value proposition. Most IT teams are underwater just keeping their own systems running. They don't have bandwidth 300 cloud security vendors. So you outsource the market surveillance to someone whose full-time job is watching the market.
And Gartner didn't invent this category, but they came to dominate it in a way that's unusual even for dominant firms. Their annual revenue is roughly $6 billion. Forrester, their closest competitor, is around half a billion. Gartner is the 800-pound gorilla, and the gorilla also writes the field guide to gorillas.
That's the part Daniel's question circles around. How did a market research firm become culturally influential enough that its quadrants dictate procurement decisions? Because that's not normal. Nielsen tracks TV ratings, but TV executives don't treat Nielsen reports as scripture. Power ranks cars, but car buyers don't use the rankings as a primary filter.
Two reasons, I think. The first is timing. Gartner emerged just as enterprise IT was becoming impossibly complex. The 80s and 90s saw an explosion of vendors, platforms, and standards wars. CIOs were drowning. Gartner offered a life raft, a single source that would tell you what to buy and what to ignore. The second reason is the frameworks themselves. The hype cycle and the magic quadrant aren't just reports. They're mental models that escape their original context. People use peak of inflated expectations to describe startup culture, cryptocurrency, dating apps. The magic quadrant's 2x2 matrix has been copied by dozens of other industries.
The hype cycle is basically Muzak. That's aware of itself as Muzak.
I need you to explain that one.
It's a framework that everyone knows is a framework. Nobody thinks it's a law of physics. But it's still useful as a shared language. You can say, we're in the trough of disillusionment on this project, and everyone in the room nods, even if nobody can define where the trough starts or ends. It's intellectual shorthand that became intellectual infrastructure.
That's exactly what makes the business model tension so consequential. When your frameworks become infrastructure, the stakes of getting them wrong, or getting them right for the wrong reasons, are enormous. If a vendor gets dropped from leaders to visionaries, that's not a bad review. That's a material business event. Deals lost, valuations affected, funding rounds complicated.
What is Gartner really selling? Research or access?
And that's not an evasion. It's literally the business model. On one side, they sell research subscriptions to end users, CIOs, procurement teams, IT architects. These buyers want independent analysis. On the other side, they sell vendor access programs. Vendors pay for analyst inquiry time, for the right to use Magic Quadrant reprints in marketing, for conference sponsorship, for strategic advisory sessions. The pitch to vendors is, we can help you understand how we evaluate the market, which helps you position your product more effectively.
Which sounds reasonable until you realize that position your product more effectively and influence your placement in our rankings are separated by a firewall that's more aspirational than architectural.
That's the central tension Daniel's prompt gets at. Gartner has never fully resolved it because the business model can't fully resolve it. You can't simultaneously sell objective analysis to buyers and strategic access to vendors without creating a structural conflict. The company's defense is that these are separate divisions with separate incentives. Research is firewalled from sales. But they both roll up to the same P&L, the same shareholders, the same quarterly earnings calls.
It's like a restaurant that also runs the health inspection.
Not a bad analogy. The restaurant pays for a service that helps it understand what the inspector looks for. The inspector is employed by the same parent company. Everyone involved might be acting in good faith. But you'd still want to know about the arrangement before you decide where to eat. Let's go back to the founding, because the origin story explains a lot about why the conflicts are baked in. Gideon Gartner was an analyst at Oppenheimer in the 70s, covering the early computer industry. He noticed something. The institutional investors he was serving had almost no reliable information about technology companies. The vendors controlled the narrative completely.
The original pitch was, we'll be the independent voice in a market where buyers are flying blind.
He left Oppenheimer and founded Gartner Group in 1979 with a simple premise. Sell research subscriptions to investors and later to corporate IT buyers. No vendor money. Just independent analysis funded by the people consuming it. For the first decade or so, that was the model. As enterprise IT exploded in the 80s and 90s, the number of vendors multiplied. Gartner realized that vendors would pay for access to the analysts who were influencing purchasing decisions. Not to change the research, at least not officially, but to understand the methodology, to brief the analysts on their roadmaps, to get inquiry time. It started as a small side business and grew into 30% of revenue.
The dual revenue stream wasn't the plan. It was an accretion.
That's what makes it so hard to disentangle. Nobody sat in a boardroom and said, let's build a conflicted business model. It evolved incrementally, and at each step, the new revenue made perfect sense. Vendors want to be understood. Analysts want to be informed. Why not charge for the briefing?
Because the briefing becomes the product. Let's get concrete about the Magic Quadrant methodology, or what we know of it. How does a vendor actually land in leaders versus niche players?
The process starts with Gartner defining a market, say, cloud access security brokers. They identify the vendors who meet their inclusion criteria, which usually involves revenue thresholds, customer counts, and geographic presence. Then analysts evaluate each vendor across a set of criteria mapped to the two axes. Completeness of vision covers things like market understanding, innovation, geographic strategy. Ability to execute covers product capability, customer experience, operations.
Here's the black box. How much does each criterion count?
That's the part Gartner doesn't publish. They describe the criteria publicly, you can find the list on their website, but the weighting is proprietary. Is market understanding worth 20% of your vision score, or 5%? Is customer experience a tiebreaker or the dominant factor? Nobody outside Gartner knows.
Which means a vendor can meet every published criterion, invest heavily in the areas Gartner says matter, and still get a placement that surprises them, with no way to audit why.
That's exactly what the 2019 Wall Street Journal investigation documented. The core finding was that Gartner evaluated its analysts partly on what they called vendor contribution. Essentially, how much revenue the vendors in an analyst coverage area were generating for Gartner.
The analyst covering cloud security has a professional incentive for the cloud security vendors to keep spending.
even if it's subtle, even if nobody says give them a better placement. The analyst knows that if a major vendor gets a bad quadrant placement and pulls their spending, it shows up in the analyst's performance metrics. That's not corruption in the envelope sense. It's structural pressure.
The 2021 lawsuit makes this less theoretical.
Small cybersecurity testing firm. They'd been in the leaders quadrant for their market segment. According to the complaint, they declined to purchase additional Gartner services, conference sponsorships, reprint rights, advisory days. Shortly after, they were dropped to niche players. NSS Labs argued their product had objectively improved during that period. More customers, better test results, expanded capabilities.
The case settled before trial, which means we don't get a ruling on the merits. But the allegations are public record, and the pattern matches what other vendors describe.
Gartner's response was that NSS Labs simply didn't meet the inclusion criteria anymore, that the market had evolved and NSS hadn't kept pace, reasonable on its face, except that the timing is hard to ignore.
Here's what bothers me most about the methodology question. It's not just that the weighting is secret. It's that the magic quadrant presents itself as a comprehensive market assessment when it's actually a narrow lens. It evaluates vendors on Gartner's definition of vision and execution, which may or may not align with what a specific buyer actually needs.
A niche player might be the perfect vendor for a mid-sized company with a specific use case, but the quadrant makes them look like a bad choice, full stop. The visual design reinforces this. Leaders is top right, big green box. Niche players is bottom left, small orange box. The graphic itself communicates hierarchy.
The 2x2 matrix as aesthetic authority. It looks like math, so it reads like truth.
That's what makes the business model tension so durable. Gartner isn't selling a product that can be objectively verified. They're selling a judgment that becomes true by being believed. If enough procurement teams treat the magic quadrant as authoritative, it is authoritative, regardless of methodology. That's where the knock-on effect gets troubling. The magic quadrant doesn't just rank vendors, it reshapes the market it's supposedly observing. Vendors and leaders get the meetings, the RFPs, the analyst calls from investors. Vendors and niche players get ghosted. It's not that the quadrant predicts market winners, it manufactures them.
Winner, take, most dynamics with a veneer of empirical rigor, which means the cost of a bad placement isn't just reputational, it's existential.
There was a cloud security vendor in 2022, mid-size, solid product, good customer retention. They'd been in leaders for 3 years, then they got moved to visionaries, the product hadn't changed. Their customer satisfaction scores were actually up, but within 6 months, qualified leads dropped 40%.
Same product, different quadrant.
That's what vendors privately call the Gartner tax, not an official fee, the cost of not playing the relationship game. If you're excluded or downgraded, you lose deals. If you want to improve your placement, you buy advisory services, attend the conferences, license the reprint rights. The pressure isn't pay us or we'll tank you, it's subtler. It's the vendors who engage deeply with our analysts tend to be better understood, and better understanding leads to better evaluations.
Which is a perfectly reasonable statement that also functions as a sales pitch.
Here's the procurement side, which is where this gets almost farcical. That 2023 survey, 68% of IT buyers using the Magic Quadrant as a primary filter. Not one input among several. The first screen, and only 12% understood the methodology.
You've got a majority of buyers outsourcing their vendor evaluation to a black box produced by a firm with a documented incentive to favor certain vendors using criteria weightings nobody outside the firm can see. That's not due diligence. Oh, that's delegation of judgment.
The delegation is often embedded in policy. Large enterprises write procurement rules that say vendors must be in the leaders quadrant to be considered. Not should be, which means Gartner isn't an input to the buying process. It's a gatekeeper.
This is where the credit rating agency parallel becomes unavoidable.
It's almost a perfect mirror. Moody's and S&P. The issuer pays model meant the bank selling mortgage-backed securities paid for the ratings. The agencies had every incentive to inflate those ratings because if they didn't, the issuer would walk across the street to the other agency. The result was AAA stamps on financial toxic waste.
The buyers, pension funds, insurance companies relied on those ratings because regulation required them to.
The ratings weren't just information. They were embedded in the legal architecture of the financial system. The magic quadrant isn't legally mandated, but it's operationally embedded in the same way. If your procurement policy says leaders only, the quadrant has the functional force of regulation.
Gartner's defense is that their model is different. The rating agencies were paid exclusively by issuers. Gartner gets 70% of revenue from end-user subscriptions. Those buyers are paying for accurate analysis, which creates a countervailing incentive.
That's not a trivial distinction. If Gartner's research loses credibility with CIOs, the subscription revenue erodes, so there's a real market mechanism pushing toward accuracy. The problem is that credibility erodes slowly. It's a lagging indicator. In the meantime, vendor revenue arrives quarterly, tied to specific relationships and specific placements. The short-term incentives and the long-term incentives point in different directions.
Gartner also points to their ombudsman office, their methodology review processes, the firewall between research and sales. And I don't doubt that many individual analysts operate with real integrity.
Nor do I. But the firewall is between divisions of the same company. They share a CEO, a board, a stock price. The structural conflict isn't about individual corruption, it's about what the business model rewards at the aggregate level. You can have 1,000 honest analysts and still produce systematically distorted outcomes if the incentive architecture pushes in that direction.
The same company sells the test and the tutoring. That's the phrase that keeps coming back.
It's worth comparing to Forrester because the contrast is instructive. Forrester's wave methodology is similar. A vendor-paid model, proprietary criteria, but they publish more detail about how criteria are weighted. They disclose the percentage contribution of each criterion to the final score. It's still not fully transparent, but it's more transparent than the magic quadrant.
The information asymmetry is a choice, not a necessity.
That's the uncomfortable implication. Gartner could publish weighting criteria. They choose not to. Their argument is that full transparency would allow vendors to game the system. The counter-argument is that opacity allows Gartner to game the system.
Either way, the buyer is the one operating in the dark.
What do you actually do with all of this? Daniel's asking us to get practical, and I think there are concrete steps on both sides of the table. Buyer side first. When you're handed a magic quadrant as justification for a vendor decision, the single most important thing you can do is read the methodology section, not skim it. Look for what's weighted and what's excluded. If the weighting criteria are vague, and they usually are, treat the quadrant as a marketing document, not a scientific analysis.
Which doesn't mean ignore it. It means calibrate it. A magic quadrant tells you something about market perception and vendor momentum. It doesn't tell you whether the product will work in your specific environment with your specific constraints. That's not a small distinction.
Diversify your sources. Use Gartner for broad market awareness, sure. But supplement with direct customer references, not the reference calls the vendor sets up. Actual customers you find through your network. Look at open source signals. GitHub activity, community engagement, how they handle bug reports. Run a proof of concept before you sign anything. Independent technical evaluation catches what quadrant placement misses.
The quadrant is a starting point for questions, not an ending point for decisions. If your procurement policy says leaders only, you turned a marketing framework into a purchasing algorithm. That's not Gartner's fault. That's your fault.
On the vendor side, the advice is different but equally practical. Understand that Gartner is a business partner, not an impartial referee. Budget for analyst relations as a marketing expense, because that's what it is. It's not a research expense. It's not an independent validation expense. It's a marketing line item, and you should be transparent internally about that distinction.
I've seen too many startups treat a good Magic Quadrant placement as proof of product quality. It's not. It's proof that you're good at the Magic Quadrant process. Those are different skills.
The broader lesson extends well beyond Gartner. Any organization that sells both analysis and access to the analyzed has an inherent conflict of interest. This doesn't mean the analysis is worthless. It means you must triangulate. Never let a single source be your entire decision framework, especially when that source has financial relationships with the options you're choosing between.
Triangulation is the word. If three independent sources with different business models point in the same direction, you got something. if your only source is a firm that gets paid by the vendors it ranks, you've got a single point of failure in your decision architecture. Here's the question I keep coming back to, and I think it's the one Daniel's prompt leaves hanging. What happens when AI-powered market analysis tools get good enough to do what Gartner does, but from public data? Automated vendor scoring, scraping customer reviews, analyzing GitHub activity, tracking hiring patterns. The inputs are transparent even if the models aren't. Does that make the Gartner model obsolete? Or does it just make Gartner more entrenched?
I've been thinking about that too, and the uncomfortable answer might be both. The technology to do independent vendor evaluation at scale is emerging fast. You can already get surprisingly good procurement insights from tools that aggregate public signals. But Gartner's moat isn't just their research, it's the institutional embedding. The procurement policies that say leaders only. The CIO who doesn't want to explain to the board why they ignored the magic quadrant.
The quadrant becomes a compliance tool, not an evaluation tool. You're not buying insight, you're buying cover.
Cover is sticky. Even if better analysis exists, the career risk of deviating from the industry standard is higher than the career risk of following it into a bad decision. Nobody ever got fired for buying from the leader's quadrant.
Which brings us to the hype cycle, and I want to sit with the irony here, because it's elegant. The hype cycle describes exactly the dynamic that Gartner itself participates in. A technology gets hyped, expectations inflate, disillusionment follows, then eventually it finds its real use. Gartner's own frameworks went through that exact arc. They were novel insights that became over-relied upon, then criticized as pay-to-play, and now they're settling into what they actually are. Useful but conflicted market tools that serious buyers treat as one input among many.
The hype cycle may be Gartner's most honest product. It describes the very dynamics that Gartner helps create.
A framework that explains the firm that built the framework. That's the kind of recursion that either makes you laugh or makes you need a nap.
Probably both, knowing you.
But the point stands. Any tool that becomes infrastructure stops being evaluated on its merits and starts being evaluated on its ubiquity. Gartner crossed that threshold years ago. The question isn't whether their research is good. It's whether the people using it understand what they're actually buying.
That's the note I think we should leave this on. Not Gartner good or Gartner bad, but know what you're outsourcing your judgment to and know what that thing is incentivized to tell you.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The mantis shrimp's legendary 16 photoreceptor types were widely cited as an interwar discovery, but the claim traces to a misreading of a 1928 Kiribati Marine survey that actually described the spectral range of lagoon water, not the shrimp's eyes. The shrimp vision myth wasn't corrected until the 1990s.
Right. One last thought, and then we're done. If the hype cycle is Gartner's most honest product, maybe the lesson is simpler than it looks. Any framework that becomes famous enough to shape the market it describes is no longer just a framework. It's a participant. Treat it accordingly.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you're listening. It helps. We'll be back next week.
Until then, do your own due diligence.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird props, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.